Hey folks, and welcome to the Deconstructor of Fun podcast. I'm your host, Mishka Katkoff, and the guest of this episode is Andy Duthie, executive producer of Hawked. Now, if you don't know Hawked, it's a game that launched 2 weeks from now, so on 15th of February, and it has attracted well over a million players till date. That's a good amount for a AAA games as a service title. Now, Andy is a very interesting character. He has a successful track record in leading AAA and AA teams. He worked well over a decade at Rockstar, where he shipped games like GTA 3, GTA 4, GTA 5, and worked extensively on GTA Online. Andy has played a hands-on role in driving change within the organizations, refining processes, introducing efficient project management strategies throughout his career at several other companies. In this episode, we'll definitely peel back the curtain on remote team management, because that's something that Andy is very passionate about. And as a matter of fact, Hawked was fully developed with a remote team. And yes, the focus will be on the crucial remote working strategies, as Andy has worked, of course, on site, in hybrid setups, and fully remote. And he'll be going through a list of things that you should be doing, things that you should be avoiding, and things you should be thinking about in terms of your setup. So if remote working is something that is very interesting for you, this is a fascinating podcast episode, diving deep into a production of a title, of a new title, with a big team, with a AAA setup, with live operations, all done fully remote. So tons of learnings, and a lot of people say you can't do this. Well, Hawked is a prime example of a game that soars despite being remotely developed. Second thing that I want to say is events. So we have, I think, 6 or even 7 events coming in March alone. So everything around Think Istanbul and GDC. If you want to be part of these events or any of the future events which we have already planned, do sign up for the Deconstructor Fun newsletter. There's a link in description. You sign up, and at the beginning of every newsletter, we'll be putting in the links for upcoming events. And we have all kinds of fun events in different setups. So we have the big ones like the Think Istanbul, Game Night that is coming in GDC, where hundreds of people gather together and learn, but at least have fun. And then we have a lot of more focused, smaller events. They could be mixers, they could be roundtables where we gather professionals of a specific craft together for a brunch event. You'll be able to connect with not only like-minded, but people you could actually share information with and learn from them, and create industry contacts, important stuff. So anyways, all kinds of fun events. We love doing them. We love seeing you around the world joining us at these events. So do sign up for the Deconstructor Fun newsletter, and sign up for the events that are interesting for you. They're fun, guaranteed fun. Anyways, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Andy Duthie, executive producer of Hawked.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond.
This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fun really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing the full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities, as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI. So what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
Competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Duthie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, everyone. My name's Andy Duthie, and I've been in the industry for over 20 years, working in both development while at Rockstar Games and then in publishing and production while at Builder Rocket Boy, Gameforge, Clang Games, and now I'm at My.Games, where I'm currently the executive producer on a new free-to-play title, treasure hunting title, Hawked.
No, well, Andy, you're making my day super easy. You're just running through the introduction. I don't have to do it. So thank you for that. And you're joining straight out of the Schwarzwald, the dark forest of Germany, where you currently live. So, and I understand you broke your rib just before the interview.
Yeah, I've had a good start to the week with falling flat in my face and landing on my arm, and now my rib's broken, so getting old is not easy.
I'm just saying, like, complimenting you on, like, thank you for having the scheduled time here, despite coming in very injured. You're ready to go to talk about your background, remote team best practices, and Hawked. So thank you, Andy.
Yeah, I'm on some fun drugs, so it's going to get me through. Whoa.
Okay, well, that's going to make a fun episode. so let's see where we land. So you gave your background a little bit. So you worked at Rockstar North for a good amount of time, working on GTA Online and GTA 5, if I'm correct.
Yeah, actually, I worked on all the GTAs from 3 onwards.
Oh wow!
So I was a developer. I started as lead QA on GTA 3. And then moved to mission scripter and designer for Vice City and San Andreas. And then from there, just continued working on them all the way through to, finished as producer of GTA Online.
We're not going to talk too much about Rockstar, but I'll have to ask, like, if you can talk about this, like, how do the ideas of these different settings come about? Because is it developed out of Edinburgh?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the main development studio is in Edinburgh. And so, it was at the time it was the president of Rockstar North was Leslie Benzies. And a lot of the overarching ideas came from a combination of himself working with the team that was in New York. So Sam and Dan Houser, who led Rockstar New York. And then the three of them really came up with the setting.
Yeah, because it's interesting, like a... I've been briefly to Edinburgh, and I kind of find it confusing that they would come up with how well they would depict in some sense, like the different settings, whether it's the San Andreas or the Weiss or other locations that are so far removed from Scotland.
It was always really surprising when we were across in America doing research trips or anything, and we got speaking to people, and then they'd ask, like, oh, what do you do? And, work for Rockstar, and they're like, oh, wow. And they'd be like, but you've got a Scottish accent. And be like, GTA is made in Edinburgh. And so, it was always really surprising for the Americans of how well we would just put things together and how funny it was for them.
Yeah, for sure. And then just kind of like it's probably even more interesting when it's coming from the outside, where you can take the elements that are more globally interesting, rather than somebody who's in that doesn't find them so interesting as you guys.
Yeah, we could definitely do a bit of tongue-in-cheek humor around that as well, because we weren't looking from the outside in, exactly as you said. So it always worked out really well for us.
So I wanted to talk about a little bit, as we're on the topic. So, of course, after GTA, you worked at Gameforge, a Clang, and now My Games, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the learnings you got from GTA Online, because that is well, it is Rockstar's more successful title. Or can you call it a title? It is kind of like an extension of a title.
For us, it definitely was. It was a separate beast in itself, mm-hmm. completely away from what we had for GTA V. So, yeah, very much we it was individually developed in-house. So, yeah.
Yeah, and in many ways, it is almost as a poster child for console PC games as a service type of a title. Like those, I mean, titles like GTA Online, I think most of the big franchises have tried to do. Some have been successful, other less than successful. So I'm really curious of, like, you were there since the beginning of Online, if I'm correct. And can you talk a little bit about the development side of Online? Like, what is the team? How does it run? I can imagine just the content cadence, like how often you do updates. Like I've never been in a, well, free-to-play or game as a service AAA or PC version. I've been on the mobile side, and mobile is much more compact, much more, I would assume, fast-paced. So I'm really curious in how the content treadmill runs on such a massive title.
Yeah, I mean, it was super, like everything we did at Rockstar was super fast-paced. That was always like a key metric for us. One of our key KPIs was getting everything done as quickly as we could and out into the players' hands. But like, GTA Online was an incredible learning for us all because it was the first time we'd done a game as a service, as a GaaS game. And it was actually a huge culture shock for us as well because we'd been really used to working super hard on a title, putting it out the door, and then that was it. We would take a break, then we'd come back, do a research trip, and come back into the next project. And with GTA Online, we pushed ourselves really hard, released it, and then realized, oh, we've actually got to now release something next month, and then next month, and the next month. And so it was a really, it took us a little bit of time to get the pace of it without burning out. And we definitely pushed ourselves probably beyond the limits to start with until we got into that rhythm. But I think that, once we actually got into a good rhythm with all of our releases, we started to look at who were the main developers that could work on each different type of release. And so we had some of the developers were really great at bug fixing. And so we would have them on at the end of every release. They would be like, come in, they would clean the product up, and then it would go out the door. Then we had some who would be looking a lot more further forwards. And so they would be working on like the project, which or the update, which was coming 3 months away from now, and they would start to build the architecture in place for it. And then we had like the core team who was coming, who would take the work from the architects and start building the next release or maybe the one just after that. And so there was this real treadmill that we had going where there was like some future work coming on, even up to a year away. Then there was a lot closer with the core team. And then we had the people that came in, the firefighters that came in and just cleaned the release up and kicked out the door. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. You mentioned a few things. Like, one is get everything to player's hand as soon as possible. Not very typical for a AAA developer to think that way.
Yeah, I think, the cadence of the updates was something that we learned very quickly that was super important for the players because we would see... this was really clear right from the very beginning. If we got into a really good cadence, and we were releasing at that time about once a month, players would come back, they'd play for a couple of weeks, or maybe 2 to 3 weeks, and then they'd go away and do something else, and I'll play other games, and then we'd release a game, we'd release the update, they'd come back again another 2 to 3 weeks, they'd head off, come back. And for them, I guess it was like slipping into a nice comfy pair of slippers. They'd come back, they'd enjoy the content, they'd buy some new stuff, and then they'd go play something else for a while. And for us, that was perfect. But then we actually slipped on a release for a bunch of different reasons. And it was almost immediate. We saw a bunch of players didn't come back again. Right? And it wasn't a long slip. It was just like half a month to a month. And so that really taught me the importance about making sure that we were delivering to the players when they needed it, and that we were keeping consistent with the deliveries as well. So yeah, that was super important. But the whole thing that we were doing was trying to get an update to have a really good amount of gameplay in there, with a lot of stuff that they could buy if they wanted to buy it, or like it wasn't a, it's not a pay to win game, it was a play to earn game, right? So the more you played, the more you could stuff you could get. And but we always had enough content in there to keep them coming, like keep them busy for about 2 or 3 weeks. And so yeah, that really just worked out really well from that side.
Interesting. So when you think it the other way, like I'm immediately thinking that you have this cadence, you release once a month, people come back and you get into this nice groove, but you release content maybe for 2 to 3 weeks, depending how active the players are. And then you notice that when you release a little bit later, you lose retention, you lose your players. Did somebody come by and say, hey, I have an idea. Why don't we release twice a month and we'll be actually growing?
Yeah, we could never, like the amount of, the size of the updates that we were putting out, we could never have gone faster. And we did play around with some of that, like doing a smaller update for, I think it was July the 4th. We had just like a fireworks update or something. Mm-hmm. And so we did investigate doing that, but we always wanted each drop to be this really like decent sized drop. So, yeah. No, and I think that's definitely something which we're still like even today that I want to continue with is like when we're releasing updates for the players, it's not just a few bug fixes, it's not just a few things that we're pushing out. It's like each one has to be a significant update for the players when we're doing our significant updates. That is right.
Yes,
yeah. We want to be delivering improvements to the players all the time, but it's bigger things I want to be getting out there.
That makes sense. And plus, if the users get used to having those nice updates where when they come back there's going to be something significantly new, then doing anything smaller doesn't really deliver, and it's going to be actually negative probably in the impact.
Yeah.
So that
you don't want to disappoint them, that's for sure, and surprise them.
But did you play around with different events? Like usually with the games that I worked on and mobile games as well, is like even in larger teams when they pushed out those bigger events or bold beats or whatever you want to call them at different companies, they still ran a lot of smaller events. So, you know, whether it's 4th of July or Halloween or stuff like that, that were more competitive, more modular in the way they've been developed. And that gave actually more time to focus on that bigger release. So you weren't necessarily on that one month cadence. You could have been on a 6 week or even 8 weeks because the live services kept it going.
No, and surprisingly, that was not something that we really dipped too much into at the time. Obviously now that's a very different. I think that as part of the live ops strategy that would be putting forwards for any title, you want to be running multiple events going on at the same time. So there's always something for the players to be enjoying. And that's definitely like how we're driving on Hawked. But with GT Online, it was very much focused around the bigger updates, get new stuff, new toys for the players to play with. That's really what we're trying to deliver, rather than having like this constant, okay, here's, Easter holiday, and now you're going to get some Easter-related toys in there. It was really just focused around the bigger things we were trying to do. And it was some big, really big updates that we delivered, especially early on.
Mm. And those bigger updates, were they premeditated for a specific amount? Like, did you have a roadmap of 2 years almost where you were developing against that?
Yeah, it was about a year. We had a roadmap ahead of time. And but also we were... some of the ideas were a little bit more short term as well. We would come up with them as we were playing and investigating things and seeing what was fun and what wasn't, and just take the each pack into a different direction. So it wasn't always just purely laid out. But in terms of the time that it took us to actually build each update, we had to have a bit of an idea, because especially for sticking a new car into the game wasn't like we can do that tomorrow, right? So
and what was, I'm just curious, like what was the size of the team back then when you were on that monthly cadence?
Big. Uh-huh. That's about all I can say. It was big.
Oh, okay, got it. So
bigger than you can ever possibly imagine, I would say.
So, oh wow. Yeah. Okay, so that makes it clear that it couldn't even grow bigger. It was that big.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh wow, makes sense. I mean, we all know from the numbers that it's one of the most successful games ever released. So, of course, like that probably wasn't an issue of how many developers you can put on it as long as they're creating that content and keeping players satisfied.
Yeah, it's done okay. It's crazy that it's still actually in the charts even today.
Yes.
It's a little while ago that we made it. And so, yeah, it's doing all right.
yeah, exactly. And then your career took you elsewhere. So it took you to GameForge. It took you to Clang. So I believe both of them are... No, one of them is in Schwarzwald, where you are, or Karlsruhe,
yeah.
Right?
Karlsruhe, yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, GameForge is in Karlsruhe, yeah.
And talk to me a little bit about kind of like your next steps in your career.
Yeah, so once I was like, so I was at Rockstar for 14 years and I'd kind of seen every part of development. So I'd seen how they build worlds. I'd seen how they make worlds sound amazing. And I really wanted to go and check out the other side of the industry. So getting into publishing and just understanding how we sell games, because while we were at Rockstar, I never touch the marketing or any of that side of publishing at all. There was really very little I did. Localization maybe was the only thing. And so, yeah, I really wanted to go and see this other side. And so, and also, as there wasn't many opportunities within Scotland for me, I wanted to go and travel a little bit as well. So we ended up in Germany and I started as a senior producer in GameForge. And GameForge may be a bit of an unknown company for some people or for a lot of people, but they're actually one of the biggest German publishers and they've been running for a long, long time and have been really successful. And so for me, it was a super nice fit. There was the team there was just great right from the start. And I started there working on Orcs Must Die Unchained, which was another great title to work on, as I'd always loved the Orcs Must Die series. Co-op games are just super interesting for me. And it was another GaaS game. And so it was the perfect next step. And so with me as producer and I had this amazing product owner, we were at the center of publishing and I learned so much in such a really short period of time. And I've always said that if Rockstar was my, like where I learned, so it was like being in school and like from the very beginnings and learning everything, GameForge was definitely like being in university where I kind of felt like, okay, now I'm becoming a professional and I'm really understanding the full scale of everything. Sadly, Orcs Must Die Unchained didn't work out for a bunch of different reasons, and which was sad. But what did work out was all the learnings that we took for how to run a GaaS game. And from like, it was so much, like we quartered the time you could do maintenances. We set up cross studio processes because the development team was in Dallas. And it actually became the basis for how I organize everything. And also, yeah, how we're even organizing stuff on Hawk today. So, and it also led me to becoming director of online operations at GameForge 2. So it was, it was a great time, I've got to say it.
Yeah, and you have an interesting step between, so you were at GameForge, you came in, Orcs Must Die, rose up to be director of online operations. Then you went back to Edinburgh to work again with Leslie on Build a Rocket Boy. And then came back to GameForge to be a COO for the company. So can you talk to me a little bit about the steps in between? Because Build a Rocket Boy seems like, you know, from everything that we've seen, it seems like GTA Online just reimagined.
Yeah, it was definitely a fun little time. And I've never had any regrets in my career. I do wonder where I would be now if I hadn't taken like that next step to move from GameForge to Build a Rocket Boy. And the reason I ended up there was like while I was at Rockstar and especially on GT Online, Leslie Benzies, so the president of Rockstar North, he reached out to let me know that he was building a new studio and he wanted me to come and work with him on it. It would eventually become called Build a Rocket Boy, although the name came in later. And so I went there as production director to just help the company get on its feet. I was one of the very early employees there. And this was actually my first time working remotely as well, because this was back in 2017, so before Corona had hit. And it was, so it wasn't something that was forced upon me to go into home office. It was something which I made a conscious choice to do. And so how I did it was I was staying in Germany, traveling 2 weeks, working for 2 weeks in Scotland, going back and working 2 weeks in Germany remotely. And so it was, just an incredible experience. And so it was great getting into something brand new and getting the chance to build, a whole studio, getting all the processes from scratch, getting a clean slate and being able to build this up, working alongside Leslie, which was just a dream. And also I got to work super closely with Amazon and see how they were doing things because we were using the Lumberyard engine. And then also we've got some really big investors from China as well. And it was really amazing to see how they were doing things. And then we had a sister studio in Budapest. So we were spreading production between Budapest, Edinburgh, Amazon and China. And it was my job to keep everything weaved together. So I learned a lot about, how to manage teams internationally at this point, and also how to build a company at speed, which is always the rockstar way, while also building a game at the same time, which was interesting.
That sounds like a handful, and that is not a small studio either. I mean,
no,
with the operations in Edinburgh, the Budapest, like how many hundreds of people are we talking about?
Yeah, like I don't know what the size is now, but when I joined, even on just on the scripting team, we had 4 scripters when I joined, and we built up to 25 scripters within 6 months or something. And so, and the scale of the rest of the company was similarly built like that. So, yeah, it was a really full AAA sized company when we left.
Nice. So 3 years there, then going back to be a COO at GameForge. And then do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because now you're taking a step from being director, from running the production to just running the whole company operations.
Yeah, I've had a weird career, or maybe a lucky career, unlucky career. I'm not sure. But every 2 years or every project, I've changed my title and I've jumped up for quite some time through the early days. And this was another jump. And really, this came about because I was, while I was traveling backwards and forwards, and it was starting to take a toll on me mentally and physically. And also, as you just said, the work was incredibly demanding and I was wearing way too many hats. And so my friends at GameForge came back and asked me to come back and kind of finish the job that I'd started before, because I'd started working as director of online operations, where I was putting all the processes into place, cleaning up the publishing side of the company and just getting everything into a really good shape. And so they got in touch with me, and I spoke to Leslie and we talked it through. And in the end, I actually agreed to stay on at Build a Rocket Boy as a contractor for 6 months while I was actually running as COO for GameForge for 6 months. I was doing both, and that was probably a bit crazy, but it was really great because I wanted to make sure that Build a Rocket Boy was in safe hands and they were moving forwards with everything that we'd built already. But also I really wanted GameForge to be leveling up, basically. And so I went back in as chief operating officer, and because I knew the company so well and what it was missing from my time before, I actually spent 6 months prior to joining working with a chief product officer on a 23 page breakdown of everything that was wrong with the company. And so as soon as it got in, it was we just got in and we started cleaning up all the processes and just building this really well-oiled machine. And that was such a learning for me. I think it was probably a step too far for me at the time, because I don't think I was I had the drive and ambition and understanding of what needed to happen, but I don't think I was in the best mental state to be able to bring everybody along with me. And that's something that I've learned since then and I've been working on. And so that was interesting times. And then slap bang in the middle of it, Corona hit. And that was a really just such a culture shock for everybody. Like, GameForge is an incredibly social company. And I think that this was around the time that we, started struggling probably as an executive team. Half the executives wanted to ignore Corona and continue like it wasn't happening, where the other half, which I was in, we were secluding ourselves and following all the rules because, Germany was very clear on what you could and couldn't do. And we missed out on these late night work sessions and talking about what we're doing and all those little magic moments of where you can sync on everything. And I think it's it's something that I've come to realize just how important those moments are for companies and how you need to really work very hard to kind of catch them in a home office situation.
Yes. And so all of the other leadership of Gameforge is in Karlsruhe, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All of them. And you still didn't even meet like outside or didn't, like Karlsruhe is probably not a big town. Like
some did, but, yeah. Well, some no. It's a small place, but some did. Like I said, there was half of the executives were mm-hmm. still going into the offices and continuing working there. But for me, I was really following the rules and stayed at home and secluded.
You must love Germany. I do. It's a cultural fit.
Actually, I really do. I yeah, really so love.
I can imagine.
I mean, the bureaucracy is tough. There's no lying mm-hmm. about that, and it's but as a country, it's a beautiful, sunny, warm place, and that's just something I've never experienced at Scotland.
Well, yeah, the weather is always better no matter where you go from Scotland, but and plus you're in south of Germany. For you know, most of the listeners, when we're talking about Schwarzwald, that's closer to the French border.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm about half an hour from France.
Yeah, exactly. So it's smack middle in the Europe.
Yeah, and it's warm, 40 degrees in summer, and so it's just a lovely place.
Yeah, for sure. So that's an interesting point that you made, the mental state to push through the changes. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, so change management is something that I've learned so much through my different jobs as I've been going, and I've learned how to, I've experienced how to do it wrong, and I've worked out how to do things a lot better now as I've kind of gone forwards. And definitely at that time, I was making, huge amounts of changes to the company. And I think that definitely didn't bring everybody along as well as I could have done. And so I'm very, I look back on it as a great learning. I think that's the easiest thing to say. And definitely taking that forwards. I think that from a change management perspective, the biggest thing that I've learned is that you need to just explain what you're doing. And I know this sounds super simple. Explain what you're doing, listen to everybody's feedback, bring their feedback into what you're doing, and then explain again what you're doing, and then keep going until everybody feels comfortable with what's going on. And some of this was brought from Rockstar, but some of the early mistakes I made was I was just like, okay, we're going to change this now, do this now, and that was it. And it was because that was how we did things at Rockstar. You rolled out a new process and the next day everybody had to follow it. Later on, it was very much this building up, making sure everybody was feeling comfortable with a change. And so, yeah, that's definitely been interesting learnings for sure.
Yeah, I understand 100% what you're saying. So when you're introducing new strategy or when you're, as you said, driving through change, it is the most grindiest project that you can assume. It's not enough to just...
draining.
Yeah. Yes. And it's not enough just to have that clear strategy, but it is, as you said, it's the core loop of conversation and tuning and one-on-ones and group discussions and making sure that people are buying in and what does it take for them to buy in into the strategy? What elements do they want to change? Because you're starting, and then that goes one layer at a time. So you're starting with the top, you might be even starting with the board, then you go through the management team or leadership team, then you go through management teams, then you go through this, then you go through that, then you're trying to coach the lieutenants to drive change through their processes, and everything happened so slowly. And I can understand that you came in, you had the list, and the list was very long, and you start to do this grindy thing. You're like, I don't have time for this, first of all. Yeah. Like, we need to make all these things happen because these are the challenges, the 11 pages that we have with the company. So I don't have time to get everybody along, and I just need to make these happen. And what probably happens with these type of situations, if the culture is not tuned to that, like a rock star culture that was very attuned to strong leaders, then it starts revolting, and that's never good for a change.
Definitely. And I think that it's you were spot on in what you said. You said it starts at the top, and that's exactly where you have to make sure that everybody's on board and is really behind the changes and is moving forward with the changes as well. And I think that's where we ended up at GameForge. It was different parts of the executive team were looking at it in different ways. And so it was an interesting learning. So it's also why I don't want to be back on an executive team again. I'm happy being executive producer.
And that is a perfectly valid revelation. Like, you don't have to always be moving. It's not even moving up. It's more like moving away from development and into this concept phase and conversational and selling type of a position, rather than working on directly on development. So it's good that you kind of went in that direction and said, hey, this is not me. I don't want to do this. And then you moved away. You went to become a head of production at Clang. And Clang is a Berlin-based developer, startup, pretty sizable of an organization. They have built this sort of a world, you would say.
With all the
hype elements you can find, from AI to crypto, I think at one point was there. But can you talk a little bit about, like, you're moving away from this executive role back to heading a production?
Yeah, and it was exactly as you said. It was because I wanted to be back in touch with games. I'd moved to the point where I was four levels away from actually touching a game. And so I was dealing with discussions about what we would be doing in the next year, but without actually having the fun of getting a chance to play any of the games that we were making. And so it was just too slow for me. And I really, my whole career has been, I've loved playing games. And even from a very early age, that's all I wanted to do. And so I got the offer. I took a big drop to go from COO back to head of production, but it was a conscious choice. I wanted to get back into games, and I wanted to go into a company which was doing something interesting. And like you said, they were making a life simulator called Seed, which was a really great idea. And when I met with the CEO there, Mundy, he just explained it in such a great way that really connected with me. It was also that some of the core team is from EVE Online, and I'd always been a huge EVE Online player, and so this was another great reason to go there. And so it was, for me, it was a perfect opportunity. And when I went into the company, I don't think they really had a good, a solid development process at that time. They were kind of in the middle of overhauling their game, and also the company alongside it. There'd been a lot of people leaving, and so I got the opportunity to bring in some of the stuff I'd learned and to get the train tracks underneath everybody and start moving forwards. I think they also gave me the opportunity to get a really interesting chunk of formal learning as well. So through my career, I'd never actually done formal training. I went to university as an accountant in finance, and I've got honors degree in accounting and finance, and then came in through the back door into gaming. And so I'd never gone and understood what Agile was, what Waterfall was. None of that. We never spoke about any of this at Rockstar. We built our own processes, and we did it the best way that we thought was the fastest way to do everything. And there I got the opportunity to go and learn about Agile Scrum and understand everything around it and being fully trained from the experts in it. And that was definitely a missing piece of experience for me, was to understand how to build an Agile roadmap while still staying on track with development. And I definitely really appreciate that, even so late in my career. So it was awesome. I really enjoyed my time there, and there was some just really, really great people that I've met, friends for life for sure.
Interesting. And that's fascinating, like running one of the biggest teams in gaming with Rockstar with GTA Online, and still not having the sort of formal education about production processes could come in as a bit of a revelation for many people.
We never knew what. I think it's not that we weren't doing anything that is being done these days. It's just that we never called it that. We learned how to do things. We were agile. We were incredibly agile. We just never called it agile back then because none of us had gone to university to learn that this was exactly the words that you should use at this time. And so we just, yeah, we got things done and as fast as possible. And that was our agile methodology, right? So it's
rockstar development.
It was just later on that we Yeah, exactly. And so it was just later on that we kind of looked back and realized, like now I can look back and realize what I was doing and how it kind of fit into different ways. So like our car manufacturing was very waterfall based and it was really clean and all the processes were, all the disciplines were really set up in a great way. So it was interesting to do that.
And so this role came about during the COVID times, 21, so probably like in the midst of the lockdowns, and probably I would assume, I mean, having traveled to Berlin during those times myself, that was a remote role for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I was only 6 hours away, but it was still remote for me, and all of the team was pretty much spread around. There was a core team in Berlin. And after, like through my time there, we moved even further away from the office. Some people moved to Spain, some to Italy, and it kind of, the company spread out. Mm. I believe recently they've actually just pulled the company back together again, which is an interesting choice to make. But yeah, it was a very much a remote role and I ran it as a remote role. I would go there like once a month for a like week or so. And at the start, as we got through it, I went less and less. But yeah, it was good. It was a full remote role.
And currently, My Games, executive producer on Hawked. Hawked has already launched. It is a shooter title, a cooperative, PvP. Looks a little bit like Fortnite. Really exciting looking of a game. You're an executive producer on that. And that is also a fully remote team, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and like that was actually another jump as well. So when I was head of production at Clang, even though I was back in games, I still felt really uncomfortable in the position that I was in. And a lot of it was because as head of production or as, and this was the same feeling I had as COO and director online operations, I would put the plans in place, I put the strategies in place for how to improve things, how to do things, but I was never directly accountable for actually doing this stuff. So if an engineering team didn't want to follow the path that we'd laid out, I wasn't the one who was leading them in order to pull them on. I was leading the leader of that leader of that lead. And then I decided to make an active choice to move to executive producer. And luckily enough, I found this amazing company called My.Games, which was set up fully for remote working, and then even better, they made me executive producer on Hawked, and honestly, I couldn't be happier. I'm now running the development and publishing teams, and I'm doing it on a title that I actually love, just playing outside of work. Like really, it's something which I love playing in my personal time, and so yeah, it's just another lucky step in my career. I think that's a gift I'm very grateful for.
Well, that's awesome to hear, because I mean, work is majority of our time nowadays, to be honest. So if you're doing something you love, chances are your life is a lot happier. And even a broken rib doesn't make you sad.
That's for sure.
So I wanted to go through your history, really, through all these positions at these great companies and the evolution and the sort of exploration of these titles, because some of them, like Rockstar, has been on site with a gigantic team. Then you have a sort of a hybrid type of a position with Build a Rocket Boy. Then you have the Game Forge, which is also hybrid in a way that you have the on-site leadership team, but then you do have the remote studios that you're guiding. And then finally going to a fully remote with Clang, and then continuing now to Hawked and My.Games. What are the sort of a, because you touched upon on several issues, like with GameForge, like how the leadership team became misaligned after people weren't spending that time together anymore. So I'm curious to hear from your perspective, looking at back at your career thus far, like what are the sort of a best practices when it comes to remote work on AAA titles? So like I think even Clang can go towards that direction of at least AA of a title. It's not a mobile game. It is a cross-platform title with very ambitious goals. So, yeah, please walk me through through these learnings.
Yeah, and remote working's been like part of my life now for 7 years. And like I said, I was there already in doing it before Corona. And so I have learned a lot. And I think the absolute biggest initial point is really focused towards companies themselves rather than just team members and employees and how you best to work in a remote environment. And it's really, if you're, are you sure you want to do it? If so, commit and don't go half in. And I think a lot of companies around Corona time, they kind of went half in and now they're pulling themselves back out. And it's really painful for a lot of employees. So like I've got friends of mine that were, like I said, moved across to Italy or moved to Spain, and they were promised that they were going to be in a remote working company and now they're not. And now they've got to either move back or find something else. And so if you're going to do it, then do it fully. The hybrid style companies, it's really difficult to do hybrid well, because you end up either with some people who are just misaligned, right? You're not there day to day. You're not hearing everything. So either if it's a hybrid one, then you probably want to have like 3 days in the office with everybody there together, and then the other 2 days doing remote working. If you try and do it like half-half, then it becomes a real pain, especially for meetings where half the team's remote, half the team's in the office, and you can't properly hear what's happening. And so, yeah, just commit. And thankfully, like my games, they are absolutely wonderfully set up for home office. And every day I'm working with colleagues all over the world, and there's never an issue with us being misaligned. We've got everything set up as best we possibly can. And then we're doing it as like high level as you can. So I think that's the big thing. And just so once you have committed, the second point is really to define really clear goals that are written down and accessible for everyone. And I mentioned Gameforge is a really sociable company. And so we had goals, but a lot of them were just, we were discussing them and they were between each other, but we never really put them on paper and adjusted them on a regular basis and shared them with the full company and made it really clear what we were doing. And so to have a really good heartbeat of the company, you need to have a bunch of different goals set up for different lengths. So what I mean is we'll have short-term goals, which will be around about a month, and it's like build this feature or drive this part of publishing forwards, and then we'll give ownership to the teams and make sure that they're driving on it. And then we'll have mid-term plans, which will be more like a month, more like a quarterly plan. So it's things like plan the next update that we've got, increase our market share in Asia, or raise player happiness by 10%. That kind of high level KPIs that we're trying to improve, or maybe happiness is a bad one because it's always an interesting thing. More engagement is probably the better phrase there. And then we'll have long-term goals, which are usually in the form of financial targets for us. And it could be finish this phase of development and release, or get another 1 million players this year, or yeah, that's the kind of goals that we're hitting, which we actually just hit with Hawked. We've hit our 1 million player mark, so we're
congratulations.
Past the first one, so that's super, super exciting for us. And the most important thing through all of that is while you're building the goals is do it with your team together. Don't have one person just telling everybody else what to do, because ideas should come from everyone and everywhere and be tied into your overall goals. But the only way that you can make people accountable and give them ownership is if you're all coming up with it together. And so that's a big part of planning. We will do that. So yeah, being goal oriented is super important.
If I can just intervene before you go down the list, two questions. Like first, for the first part, which is commit and don't go half in. Do you consider a hybrid better or worse than fully on-site or fully remote?
Yeah, I actually do. I think it's worse than either. I feel that it's a half way of doing it, because it ends up with most of the people having to be there anyway, because they're going to have to go into the office and do a couple of days a week, right? So you're generally in the area anyway. And if you're in the area anyway, why not just be in the office to gather and learn everything, right? I think it's definitely a personal thing. I don't think it's a professional like thing that I would say. But for me, remote working is actually the full way. If I opened a studio tomorrow, I would be fully remote. I don't even think I would bother with a studio at all. I would have areas that we could work together if we needed to go and do meetings or things like that, specifically around topics. But otherwise, I would go full remote. So, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I was visiting one studio recently, and they were working in a hybrid mode, and everybody lived, as you said, in the same city. Nevertheless, they worked hybrid, and they came in on 2 days a week, so those were set days. And I came in on a day that was not marked as a working day. And we're talking about a studio in a large city with well over 100, I would say between 100 and 200 places or desks, so everybody had a desk, and it was empty. And it is kind of confusing that that you're paying this rent in the middle of this city, and most of the time it is actually empty. And that particular studio was also thinking about, because they were growing and they were thinking about going to a larger studio space, and they needed more desks because they've set it up in a way that everybody has to be on 2 days a week. So everybody comes in then, and then on the other time, it is a ghost town.
Yeah. And imagine just how much money they're burning on those ghost towns. I would much rather take that money and put it into the development of the game rather than into the building itself. And so, yeah, no, definitely, that's exactly one of the big reasons why. And also, I just think that everybody in the world these days is much better suited to working remotely as well. We've gone through it all together, and it's much easier to work with outsourcers and everything like that too.
Yeah, well, you're a proponent of that. And I wanted to ask the second question of doing goals together. Like, how do you do that remotely? You mentioned that you build through short-term goals. Those are the tasks, basically, you have to complete. Then the midterm goals, which are quarterly KPIs to improve. Long-term goals, which are usually financial targets. All of them done together. How?
Yeah, very much so. And so we talk a lot. In order to, like, this was one of my points I was going to talk a little bit ahead with. I'll just pull it up just now. It's you got to meet regularly with your people in a remote office, and you got to talk. And like I said, when you're not in the office together, you miss those little moments of magic, and so you've got to create them again. And so I'll do things like, we'll have a Friday strategy meeting. I do it late on a Friday, and it's actually specifically around us trying to get through, like, get the week out of our heads before we go into the weekend. And so we'll spend some time in there, and we'll talk about the top five issues that we've got right now, and then we'll start putting together plans of how we're going to do it. And then some of these will become long-term plans, some of these will become short-term plans. When we're building our business models, we do it together as a leadership team. And so it's not the full hocked team that's like completely all together building it. It's more a subset of each department. So I've got my development director, my creative director, I've got the marketing brand manager, we've got our publishing producer, and we all do it together. And then they in turn will be going and speaking to their team, understanding what needs to be improved, and the ideas will flow up. So for example, a great one just now is, we're in the process of updating or releasing the game, and we released it on all the different platforms except for Xbox One. We saw that the performance on Xbox One just wasn't where we wanted it to be. And so one of the team members was taking a look at the performance and has some really good ideas about how we can improve it. And so we made the call to hold back Xbox One and implement his improvements, or the improvements that he was putting forwards, and then we'll release it later on. And so that became a goal which came up through the leads into the plan, into our plans, and now we've built everything forwards like that. And so it's really sitting down and talking with everyone, and again, listening to them is so important, because when you everybody will tell you the pain points. Sometimes they're not so good at understanding like how to fix things, but they're very good at telling you where the problems are. And so like that's definitely one of the things I learned along the way, is just to listen to everybody in any position and not to be precious or egotistical, which I've seen others being.
Yeah. And so creating moments of magic, really focusing on listening and having, you mentioned, strategic or tactical meetings on weekly basis. So those are remote meetings, right?
Everything's remote, yeah.
How do you make a good remote meeting? This is a good remote meeting, I'm just saying, but this is a different one. This is a podcast, so...
Yeah. No, exactly. Being efficient, I think, definitely is one of the key points. So going in with a really good agenda, making sure that everybody understands why they're there. And then if it's a team which I've not been having regular meetings with, then the first thing I'll do is definitely set the scene for the meeting. Hey, this is why we're here. This is the type of meeting. So, for example, if I know that people are going to come in with defensive attitudes or maybe just be negative attitudes, then I'll call it a green flag meeting, and I'll tell them at the start, hey, this is a green flag meeting, so we're going to focus on positivity and focus on positive attitudes and actually bring forward positive ideas. Let's keep the negativity out. This is just brainstorming. Doesn't matter if we're all wrong. Let's just talk about it. And so just trying to set the scene right at the very beginning of the meeting is super important. Then once you're flowing, just keep everybody talking and asking questions and seeing where they go with it. Also, you've got to lead the meeting pretty tightly as well, so that people aren't going too far away from the agenda, or they spend ages talking about something that's just way too in depth. And so I've learned to be pretty good at grabbing the mic back and just being like, okay, thanks, that's really awesome. We'll can maybe take that into the next meeting. And then finishing off with a good protocol and making sure, because we talk a lot and sometimes you forget the next day what we've actually covered and what we've talked about. So making sure that you've written it down as well is the important part.
Basically sending a memo and following it up and keeping clear on that.
Yeah, your action points, yeah.
These are very orchestrated meetings in many ways, because there is an agenda before you start a meeting. Tight reins around the topic, of course, keeping the meeting focused, asking questions. How do you do a meeting where you mine for information? And usually what I mean by that is, let's say we're having a meeting and there's several people, not one-on-one. And oftentimes what I suggest and what I've done as well is mine for conflict, meaning finding people who are disagreeing and having them actually debating each other openly about the issue, so that the decision can be made, rather than, you know, people having, as you know, the buy-in that was difficult, like, no, let's air everything out. So it is quite easy to do that when you're in the same setting, because you can read the body language quite fast when somebody's taking a step back, or they move in, or they start looking at different directions, or they start drawing something. You're like, hey, what do you like, Jessica, what do you think about what Paul is saying? That kind of stuff. So how do you do that? How do you mine for conflict?
Yeah, playing devil's advocate is exactly that. And that was something which I saw in some of my previous teams. It was just people who were just amazing at doing that and just always being there, just naturally taking the opposite opinion in order to promote conversation. And so it was something that I learned as well. And I think that you're right. It's when you do... Again, like I was saying with the asking of questions, that would be some of the questions I would be asking, is just making sure that we're being candid and being honest about how we're feeling about something. And so definitely the end of the a topic, I will take a pause, wait 10 seconds, ask if anybody's got ideas, if there's anybody's got any problems with it. And that pause and silence is often enough to promote somebody to come up and talk. But this also is really important, where you have to build your whole leadership team around not being afraid to come and talk and bring up the opinions, right? Because I've seen leaders who will just be, who will drive by fear, and then nobody wants to say anything. And that's really important that you make people feel psychologically safe to be able to come and bring forward those points for and talk against people, and then for you to just make sure that it's an actual discussion and not a two people ending up arguing about something, right? So yeah, it's I think that's a really important part for it. Yeah, and then people naturally do it. Will naturally come and talk then.
Yeah, and it's and part of it is also, I mean, these are just very practical things, but when mining for conflict, it's very important to let the participants know that you are mining for conflict and that conflict is good. Yeah. And when they are having conflict, you should interrupt and say, this is good. This is very good. I like, this is exactly what we want. Because at some point, when people are on the same team, they will start pulling back. Well, okay, you know, they're kind of like calming it down and finding a middle ground, but you don't want that. You want them to go all in so that you can make that decision after truly understanding the positions of everybody, rather than the sort of a you know, watered down version that where everybody is unhappy.
Yeah, to be creative, you have to destroy. I think that's the easy part of it, and so there has to be a bit of spice in there as well sometimes.
Yeah, it makes the meetings interesting. I'm asking of this because I bet most of the people who are having meetings are just dissatisfied with the meetings. That is why people don't want to have meetings. And I think the problem with the meetings then is not the fact that you have meetings, which I assume, especially in a remote setup, you have to have extra amount of meetings. But I'm just diving deep into this topic is because when you have meetings and when you have a lot of meetings, you have to invest significant portion of your efforts to make those meetings interesting. Otherwise, people will be highly disengaged during the meetings, trying to do their own work behind closed camera or just typing or just Googling or doing something else. And the whole purpose goes out. Like they, you know, it's a tough one with a remote meetings because you can't see the actions. Unlike you can have a proper debate and proper conversations where everybody is looking each other in the eye. So that's why I was kind of diving deeper into the meeting part.
Yeah, like I'm really lucky with the teams that I've got is that they are really engaged. Like the Hawk team is, everybody's super motivated right now to make Hawk the biggest success we can do. And so I don't think we've really struggled with that point in the past. It's definitely been an issue, especially people just turning their cameras off and that, like you just don't know what they're up to, and even if they're there. And so, yeah, you've got to make sure that you're getting engagement from your teams. But I think that comes into one of my other points is that just given candid feedback is really important, and especially in a remote environment. And if you're not feeling that somebody's being engaged, it's just coming and having a chat with them and really explaining how it makes you feel when they're not being engaged. And I've found that that's to be really effective way of understanding what the problems are. We also do a lot of like team surveys and just on a regular basis to understand where the problems are, what people are feeling, what we can be doing better from a leadership team. And we do that through our retrospectives. And then making sure that we follow up with actually doing action points from their feedback as well. So we are constantly improving as a team. And all of these things help to make the team feel engaged and make them feel heard and part of the story. So.
How do you give candid feedback? Well, like what are your learnings there?
Yeah, so I mean, being Scottish, it's pretty easy for me to go and be quite pointed about what's up. I think that, yeah, like I said, just explaining what the problem is and making sure that you're not pointing fingers at a person, you're just explaining what the problem is. That's really important to start with. So, for example, if you say that Bobby is a problem because he's not doing this, whereas you actually look at what the problem is and you investigate what the problem is, and then you try and then you go and talk about that problem specifically to the team, then that's a much more useful thing. Then explaining how it feels for you. Why is it a problem? What does it make you feel, and how does it impact the team? And then just being really straightforward with them. And this is always how I've done it. It's just being neutrally toned, listening to what they've got to say as well once they do it, and then trying to come to a conclusion. So, yeah.
So basically using the, I don't know if you've had this framework, but nonviolent communication framework.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a, you can easily, so for people, just search it on Google and you'll find the framework for that. That's a very good point. And something that I've also learned, I think it might've been actually a person from Rockstar that helped me to give feedback. If I remember correctly, but no, it was, you're smiling. You're like, oh no, no, not that type of feedback. But yeah,
I was wondering where you were going with that one.
No. It was actually a good one. It was more about the sort of American or Anglo-American way of giving a shit sandwich, where you're offering a compliment, then you're following with the feedback, and then you're ending with a compliment, where the person is really confused in the end what happened and thinks everything was great because they received double compliments, and the actual beef was left untouched. And so that was an important part that was giving to me as a feedback, is like, when you give feedback, just focus purely on that feedback. Do not do compliments in the same session. It will be just simply confusing.
That's it. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's exactly that. It is confusing. People can come out with the idea that they've done really well because they've only heard the positive rather than the actual problem. And so, yes. Yeah, I fully agree with that. Yeah.
That's how we get it. Mixed feedback is the worst feedback.
Yep.
So we have a quite of a list. Commit, don't go half in. Define clear goals that are accessible for everyone everywhere. Meet regularly and talk. Give candid feedback. Do team surveys and retrospectives. Have good meetings. What else are we missing from a really good remote setup?
Yeah, so being data informed, and this kind of touches a little bit onto the metrics of the team happiness. And I think it is a bit of a delicate subject, because being data informed about your team and not just about the metrics on the game or the financials or anything like that, which is obviously super important in any GaaS game. And we've definitely got it set up in a really great way at my games, but for looking at your team as well. So if it's a development team, then you probably want to be doing something like story points and understanding how long that they're committing the right amount of work, they're able to get through it on time, and that they're not overburdening themselves and making sure that they're delivering on time, right? And then on the publishing side, we've got our retrospectives. I've got their happiness surveys, and we are always listening to what the team needs, looking at the number of bugs that people are putting in, how that's developing as we go through the project, and how we're managing to get those bugs cleared. So there's just so many different metrics that you can be tapping into. And like I said, it's a sensitive topic, because you have to make sure that people feel comfortable that they're not being watched and they're not being micromanaged with these metrics. And you're always trying to look at the story behind the metrics and the trends, and really that's what I'm looking for anytime, is trends. So from a happiness perspective, am I improving the service department's relationship with my team over time, rather than on one day one of our metrics is down, right? And so yeah, definitely look at the trends.
That's a good one. I've seen in companies where, for example, like talking about looking behind the numbers and talking about trends, is they were doing a happiness survey with all the different departments, and one specific department was always overachieving, and people were really happy in that department, but there wasn't a metric that would have measured how happy others are with that department that is very happy about being in that department. And it only got through as you were having conversations with people and kind of digging for conflict and understanding what are the pain points in the organization, was that this super happy department, which was a support function, was not actually supporting very well others super than stable. Themselves. Yeah. And so the people in that department loved their department head, but the people relying on the support from that department did not love the department head. So that kind of gives that the fact that even though somebody can get a really great number, it you have to put it into a context and understand it in a broader spectrum. So understanding the organization first and then building the metrics around that is vital.
Yeah, understanding the story.
That's
exactly it. And that's what I, whenever I'm starting to introduce metrics into a team, that's the very first thing I'll say is, I'm not looking at individual metrics. I'm looking at the trends and I need to understand the story behind it. Because if you just look at the numbers, and I've seen people do this, and it is always such a bad idea. This development team is 50% efficient, or 50% of their work they're managing to get out this month. Yeah, okay, but three of them are ill, right? They're two of them are on holiday. So there's the story behind the reason, the numbers. And if you only look at it on a actual output perspective, then that's the wrong way to go around it. So yeah, being sensitive with it and just understanding the story is the important part.
Yeah.
I think the other ones that I've got are very much smaller pieces of feedback and more on a personal and really aimed at employees and mental health, I think, actually, and how you keep yourself sane in a remote working environment, because it can, it's not easy. When you are by yourself every day, just looking at a screen, I don't know how tall you are. I don't know what your dimensions are. It's we haven't met and we can't interact. And it's so interesting to get into that environment where you are feeling super comfortable with people. And so I think there's definitely some don'ts around that. And one of the big ones is Slack. So using the communication tool Slack, and we use this at My Games to communicate with our development teams. One of the best features they had was to add in timed messages. And so when I'm out and about, my ideas come to me whenever I'll be in the shower, I'll be out for a walk, I'll be watching movies. And previous bosses of mine would definitely they'd get an idea and they'd send it to me. It would be middle of the night, then I'd get up in the morning and it would be oh no. And one of the things that I've really tried to do is to kind of queue up messages and send them through the working hours. And so it's just not, because every time that you are impacting somebody's rest, you're breaking them just that little bit. And so I want people to be having a really good working life environment where they're able to recover and then they come back in full on the next day, rather than being a little bit broken and coming in just under weather or something. And so unless it's something super critical, then it can all usually wait till the next day. And so actually just using timed messages, so you're not poking people outside of the working hours.
That's a really powerful point. And I think that comes through, like you mentioned, in your previous jobs and then in your current, you're doing, these are happening differently. But I would say it's a lot about the people in the leadership position. And if the people are founders, that is the only way that they have worked, because they started with so under-resourced, so scrappy, and this was the way. You work long hours and there's no off switch. You're constantly on, and you assume that the team around you is also constantly on because you're in a battle. And even when the organization goes into quite a stable position, the people are still reverting back to what got them there. And if that was their ways of working and this reaped that result, you can go and say, hey, this is not the right way of working. Excuse me, which company did you build? So that's their, that's their kind of a perspective. And then when you go to a more mature organization where the founders are long gone and it has evolved to the next stage, then it functions in a much more professionally managed way. So I think that plays a big role. And I know I've tried to go through those stages as well, having been on the receiving end of that kind of a communication, having been the one who gives that type of a communication as a founder, and then trying to get into a position where this is not critical anymore because we're not a startup anymore. So let's just leave it for the morning. Communicating that to the rest of the leadership team is we don't need to do this anymore. This is not how we operate. So the switch, but yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. I'm just trying to give a perspective that from founders' perspective or others, they're not trying to be, bad people.
No, absolutely. And that's definitely not the point. It's for sure. And especially, like you said, moving from 0 employees to 50 employees is a completely different company than 50 employees to 100 employees. And that is very much an interesting change that you need to make in terms of culture within the company as well. So yeah, for sure. There's no question about that.
Do you feel that there's more mental health issues with remote setup, that you have to be proactive at tackling, than there is within the fully on site?
I think in today's world, we are just a lot more conscious about mental health as a whole. And so it's difficult to say that there's more within the remote environment specifically. I think we're just a lot more conscious about it. Like I said earlier on, I went through really working on my mental health myself. Like there's kind of the three things that I really worked on, and this is super important for anybody in a remote environment. One of them is eating well. And I know that this is like super generic advice, but I'll explain why it's super important because it's been ignored for such a long time. But just eating well, exercising well, and then really working on your mental health. And so I, about 3 years ago, I picked up a therapist and started like looking into, just everything, my background, my childhood, and started working in making myself a better person, or just at least being able to deal with difficult situations and stressful situations. And I think that has helped me to be able to work in a remote environment in such a much better way than I think I was before, where if somebody said something, I would get I would be frustrated, and it would play on my mind for too long. And now I'm a lot more accepting of just everybody's got different opinions, and it's like we're all trying to do the best. And so there's been a huge change around that. And I think that those three parts is, if you're going to be in a remote environment, is really look after yourself from those sides. Eating well, I moved into the keto diet, and I'm not trying to like push a specific diet onto everyone, because everybody needs to find what works for themselves. Keto works for me, so that's a low carb diet, and it just means that I feel like I've got more energy, and I'm able to just keep going a lot further than I could before without crashing from sugar overload. I got a gym instructor, and so because you're sat at your desk for so long and you're not really getting out and about as much as you would have been, whether you're going to the office, you're moving around the office, when you're just like moving from your house to your desk and back to your house again, which is the same place, it's you need to be getting that exercise going to keep yourself healthy so that you're looking after yourself in your old age. And then, yeah, the mental health part, which when I was younger, it was just not something which was ever spoken about. It was laughed at, actually, from the part of Scotland that I came from. And so I'm very glad that it is something that I've invested in, and it's definitely something I would really advise others to invest in as well.
Yeah, good for you to raise that. Actually, this is no secret, I've also used professional help on that mental health side. It's I understand with how it was perceived in Scotland, the land of the brave heart, that probably going to a shrink is not the first thing you do. You rather go to a pub, and there's plenty of shrinks around there after a couple of pints.
Yeah, so, there certainly is, that's for sure.
Great advice with medication, but that's a powerful thing. And I've also, when I started doing it, I kind of like fooled myself that this was mental coaching, like what athletes do, to get on, you know, into that type of a thing. But I totally understand where you're coming from, and it is very helpful when you find that right type of therapist. It has to, like, for people who want to try a therapist, that you have to remember, this is like going to a restaurant. There's different type of chefs. You might not like all the cuisine. So don't quit after your first try. Rather pick a new therapist and see what type of a ways of working works for you. But it is it is quite great. And it's not always, you know, talking about your background and blaming your parents. Like, that is not the the goal of a therapist. It's more about exploration of you and what are the locks. Like, I've had as well, like, plenty of issues that I needed to actually deal with that I didn't. And it has been quite helpful. And it brings a different side of you. And I've seen, like now talking to you, Andrew, like, very calm and collected. And I think that is an evolution step. Probably you weren't like this in your first half or even mid half of your career. And it's a lot of the sort of goals that you put forward and you don't achieve. And then you go back to being introspective, like, what caused me to not succeed in that? And then improving from inside, that helps a lot with the rest of it. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going circles, but I've done through the same thing, and I'm just trying to encourage others too.
Yeah, I really think you and I could talk about that for a long time. I think everything you said there is absolutely spot on, for sure. Definitely.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Anyways, but this is not a psychology session.
I know.
So with all those aspects, I mean, there's a quite of a list, and yeah, taking care of yourself, I think that is the final piece. And even, like, what I try to do as well, like, I mean, I've gone to a therapist. I understand the point of eating well, not on keto, but a different diet, and overall, just having, like, even putting into your calendar the time when you exercise is a really powerful thing, and that is, like, the self care and leaving your home, your phone away from you when you're at the gym, so that in between your workouts you're not opening up a Slack message and, hey, this just came to my mind, I need to write. Like, no, just focus on you, listen to a podcast, listen to music, take care of yourself. And that is really important in the type of project that we do, which are, like, 10-year development of a live service. You have to be on top of your game, so taking care of yourself is really important for the goals that you're trying to achieve as a team.
Yeah, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. That's what I always say. And you need to be in good shape for that. You can't just be burning out too early. So my dad always said, don't burn the candle at both ends. And I think that's a very apt way of putting it. So, yeah.
All right. So before I let you go, can you talk a little bit about Hawk? So you've been on the project for 8 months. It's launched globally. It's crossed 1 million in installs, fully remote, led by you, your control of the roadmaps, the team, the P&L, the ways of working, the growth strategy. Tell me a little bit more about the other project and the learnings that you're using to drive this one.
Yeah, like I said, it's been such an, I'm so lucky to be able to work on this title, because it's exactly the type of game that I love to play. And so we launched Hawked on February 15th on PC, PlayStation, and Xbox. And that was after a few months of doing early access on PC, and where we were just learning how things were working. And since then, it's just been really great to get it out the door and see the reaction of the players. And so we've got over 1 million players already trying it out, and we know that we've got something with a lot of potential. That's what the players are telling us. And like all gas games, it is very much just the seed that we've planted right now, and now we need to kind of grow it from here. And so, yeah, really, like, looking at all of my history is coming into play into this, because, as you said, I've got to run the development teams, I've got to run the publishing teams, I've got to deal with the roadmaps, making sure that we're doing everything right. We've got to be making sure we're hitting our financial targets. And it's just so much fun, actually. That's really what it comes down to. Every part of my job now is fun. And after making this step, and it was a scary step away from production into purely executive production, it's, even though it sounds the same, it's very much not the same. I've got the ultimate accountability, and I've got the team working around me, and it is just so enjoyable.
And how big is the team right now?
We've got a full team. So we've got a full development team, full publishing team, and I think actually half the company is probably helping us right now, because we are at launch stage. And so we are every discipline that you can imagine is involved with us.
So hundreds of people.
Yep. Hundreds of people for sure. Yeah.
And are you still growing the team, or, like, what is the phase of development, or just going through this early? Is it, like, globally launched? It's on Steam. You can download it. It's free to play.
Yep. Yeah, it's not globally launched. So it's on, yeah, it's on PlayStation 5, PlayStation 4, Xbox Series, S and X. The only console it's not on is Xbox One just now, so from Xbox and PlayStation. And yeah, free to play. And right now we're at the stage where it's fully released. And so we are in the live operation stage. That's where we're at. And so we're just building up towards our next update for it. So we've just got through like the first 10, 11 days of craziness from the actual launch and trying to get stability. And it's been incredible. Just the amount of players that have actually hit us. We hit some server issues. And so now we've been, like, we had first to sort those out. And now we're getting into the point of actually moving towards our regular updates, our regular events, and actually our seasonal releases, which we call issues. Hawked is very much a comic book style game, and so we're leaning very heavily into that with issues for our seasonal releases.
Yeah, beautiful. It's very stylized, and I mean, if you like Fortnite, probably will like this game as well.
Yeah, I think we've got a lot more behind the scenes than Fortnite. Like the way that it's actually built up is, so when you join the game, you start in the Riftwake, which is like the player hub. It's this floating submarine around an island called Exile. And so you start off there, and this is a little bit different because you've got this period in between the matches where you come back and you get to chill out and meet all the characters that are around the Riftwake. Part of the company called Grail, which is who's hired you to go and steal some treasure from the island. And so it's a really interesting part where you can just come and hang out with people, right? It's a social hub, basically. And then once you're ready to go on an expedition, you pack up your gear, you get ready, and off you go to the Exile to go and steal some artifacts from the island and escape back to Riftwake again with them.
Nice. Everybody can download this. It's as you said, free on all the platforms, all the key console PC platforms. And are you hiring for the project or just...
No, we're pretty stable right now, actually, because we've got through the launch period. I think it's now a time where we are in a good shape with both sides of the teams. And like that's definitely been an interesting challenge, has been getting everybody into the right places since I joined. But no, we're in a pretty good shape. And yeah, just looking forward to the future and growing the game. That's really where we're at.
Awesome. Well, Andy, I'm going to let you go back to development of this beautiful game. Thank you so much for joining for the conversation. A lot of great insights on games as service and how to work efficiently remotely. All in or all out? That's the way.
That's a big question, but yeah, thank you so much. It's been really great. Super interesting. Looking forward to speaking to you again.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you everybody for listening. And Hawked, Steam, PlayStation, Xbox, all the platforms, free. No reason not to play. So give it a go. Super pretty game. So thank you everybody for listening. Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.